beginning paragraph on page 13?
Last paragraph 14. Ooh. Verse 25.
As the rishis.
Yeah, as the rishis.
So just to quickly review the Great Soul Manuscript's reaction to the curse of Shingi was, rather than making some emergency or whatever arrangement to save himself, he immediately quit his post as the greatest king of the world, the emperor of the world, and went to the bank of the Ganges and sat down there to prepare himself for departing this world. And because of his greatness as a Kshatriya, the Brahmanas, not only from the region of Hastinapur, Uttar Pradesh, not only from India, not only from the planet Earth, but from all over the universe, great Brahmanas and sages, they arrived with their disciples. So we're talking about hundreds and thousands, hundreds of thousands of outstanding teachers and learned authorities of the Vedic Shastra. So they all came to witness the glorious departure of this great soul. That gives us an idea of Maharaj Parikshit's standing. Again, not only in Uttar Pradesh, or whatever it was called then, or this planet Earth, but all over the whole universe. So, the king, taking advantage of this extraordinary sadhusanga, as we heard yesterday, he put two questions to this assembly of sages. Number one, this is from the Nimesha number 8, I'm just reviewing. What is the duty of a human being in all circumstances? That means from birth to death. And that is interestingly answered actually in the Chandogya Upanishad, that the human being is born, lives, and even dies for one purpose, and that is yajna. The human life is meant to be a sacrifice. And that never changes. That is Sanatana Dharma. That's a very good key to, sometimes people will ask us what is Sanatana Dharma, because in many people's minds it is synonymous with the so-called religion Hinduism, which is just an amalgamation of different sects overshadowed by Mayavadi philosophy. So what is Sanatana Dharma? So Sanatana Dharma is this, the dedication of an entire human life to yajna. And this is true throughout the four yugas, because as hopefully everyone here knows, that even in Kali Yuga there is a yajna that is the single purpose of our existence as human beings in this world, and that is the Sankirtan Yajna. Those who perform this Sankirtan Yajna, which is of course very simple, then actually the value, the artha, because that's how it follows, it still follows the same way, dharma, artha, kam, moksha, even that is there in Sankirtan, but meaning different things than these words are ordinarily understood. But the artha is, just to show the difference, the artha means that one at least is liberated. And that's considered the end. You see, the Chaturvarga, moksha, is at the end. You know, you go through dharma, performing your different sacrifices, then artha, in this case means wealth, generally, and then kama, with your wealth you can engage in sense gratification until you get sick of it, and then the mind automatically turns to getting free of material entanglement, because the kama, the great promise of sense gratification, hasn't turned out as the manufacturer's guarantee stipulates.
Money back guarantee.
Prabhupada used to, I'll do this because only because Prabhupada did, but Prabhupada used to quote that world famous Rolling Stones song, "I can't get no satisfaction." That's what one learns from the experience of karma. So it's natural that the mind will turn to thoughts of moksha. But in the Kali Yuga, the process of religion, because it is so rare, because people are so fallen, therefore, actually, what the benefit one gets from it, we cannot really imagine. It's inestimable. And Bhagavatam already, just at the halfway point in sixth canto, gives us insights into that with the story of Ajamil, the narrative of Ajamil. Imagine Ajamil, how degraded he had become. And he chanted the name of Narayan just as the Yamadutas were upon him. Maharaj explained how one can get the certificate. I am a bona fide Yamaduta.
That's right.
Like the FBI, they have this big thing, they wear FBI pictures. Yamaduta, how one can earn one of those. So these Yamadutas came with their contorted faces, all very, in this aggressive, angry mood, enthusiastic to drag Ajamil from the Linga Sharira out of the Stula Sharira, the sun body out of the gross body. And the dogs were there. I don't know if you know, but there are two dogs that always go with the Yamadutas. They have names. One of them is Sharaba, I've forgotten the other one. And these dogs have four eyes. That means nothing misses them. They see everything. You can't do or even think anything that these dogs don't see with their four eyes. So, as Maharaj explained, pious souls go to what's called the Yama Shabha, the Shabha or the assembly hall. Even those who are qualified to be Pitris, they're taken there. And in that case, the dogs are their very grim guard dogs, you see. In other words, they're not, I know, because I grew up in a military family. My father was what is known as a lifer, a man who spent his whole life in the military. So, since the Second World War, up until the end of the 1960s, when he retired, and he was first in the USAAF, United States Army Air Force. The Air Force and the Army were once one military unit, and then after the Second World War, they divided, so it became the USAF, United States Air Force. So he was an Air Force Master Sergeant. Anyway, we'll talk about that.
Another time.
The master sergeants, or in the British military, they call them sergeant majors. They're like the mad dogs of the different ranks, because their purpose is to keep the lower ranks in order on behalf of the, there's this expression, an officer and a gentleman. So the officers are supposed to be gentlemen. They're supposed to, you know, be very cool, calm, collected, and not get angry in front of the men, just be very serious. And it's the master sergeants, or in the U.S. Army they're called top sergeants, and the U.S. Marines are called gunny sergeants, and in the British military, British Army, they're called sergeant majors. They're the ones who just go all like wild dogs on the men, on the doctors, the brutal police. See, so you're lucky, you're all lucky we're not following that system. We have a total maniac in charge of you, screaming. You know, they're the ones who put their nose this far from yours, just start screaming at the top of their lungs, using all kinds of foul language. Anyway, we don't want to talk about that. But, anyway, these dogs are like that. And they keep the departed souls under control, so... oh yes, I wanted to say, I grew up in such a family, so I remember that in the U.S. Air Force, and particularly where they guard the planes, they have these, you know, very expensive, and sometimes they're, well, they're always considered high security machines, representing the acme, the cutting edge of American technology. And so they're always under very strict guard. So you have in the Air Force these highly trained human guards, very good shots with their weapons, and very observant. And not only that, they have these dogs, generally they're German shepherds. And these dogs have been trained in such a way that they're only obedient to that one man, that one soldier, who keeps them on a leash. And if that soldier sees, that guard sees someone, say, climbing over the fence to come onto the flight line to take a good, closer look at the airplane, he just lets the dog go. He just lets go of the leash. And the dog will run to that person and literally tear him apart. Because that's how the dog is trained. A dog will jump at that person's throat, rip it open, and just keep chewing until the man comes and says, okay, stop. Then the dog will stop, its jaws all bloody. And these kind of dogs, after they've done their, they also have a term of service, some years, and then they get too old. And you know what happens to them? Do you think that there's some high security guard dog retirement home? No, they're immediately shot because they're so dangerous. Because unless it's that one man who's giving the order, anyone else they cannot be trusted with. They can just immediately look, jump at your throat and rip it out. So these dogs of Yamaraj are the archetype of those kinds of dogs. Archetype means they're the, you know, the metaphysical model from which those kind of dogs are fashioned. And they have four eyes, nothing this. So if one is a pious soul, then these dogs walk on either side like guard dogs, you know, protecting him. But also their whole mood is such a way that the pious person walking between them, he's kind of walking like this, making himself as narrow as possible, and he doesn't reach down to pet those dogs. In fact, he very much wishes they weren't there. There they are, and they take him. And of course, the impious dogs, or the impious souls, well, the dogs, that's their meat, that's their... That's lunch. They become lunch for these dogs. They bite them. And of course, it's the subtle body, so the subtle body, even though feeling the repeated intense pain of the jaws of these dogs, you don't quit the subtle body. You have to stay and experience that pain. So it's said in the Bhagavatam that every time these dogs bite the departing soul, they remember their sins. They understand that for that sin I committed when I was 12 years old or whatever, I just received this bite. So anyway, to complete my thought, I've gone way off track now. The purpose of human life is yajna, is sacrifice. And in every yuga there's a yajna. So, yes, and in Kali Yuga it's Sankirtan Yajna. And we have no way to estimate the artha of Sankirtan. It's at least moksha of other ages. At least. If you chant, as long as you don't chant in Nama Parad, but if you chant, there's these four kinds of abhas chanting. And that's what Ajamil was doing. He was saying the holy name Narayan, but he was not intending to address the Lord. He was calling for his son. And the result of that is that even though he was so grossly sinful, because he began as a boy, he was still a boy, because they in Vedic age they married the boys very young. The marriage would be arranged even while they would be in the Gurukul. You see, the boy might be 7 years old and he's already got, it's not that he's living as a grihastha, but the wife is already planned out. When he gets out of the group, well, there she is, you see. No. And sometimes, as he gets a little older, he'll be able to meet with her shortly. And the attachment between them will grow. She's thinking, this is my husband. He's thinking, this is my wife. So the attachment becomes very, very deep, even before they enter the griha, the home. That's the proper way to do it. So all of that though should be a yajna, done as sacrifice. So if one chants the holy name, even not intending to address the Supreme Lord, still, as we see, Ajamil, he was liberated. In other words, he had so many, as a young boy, as I explained, he was collecting articles of sacrifice for his father to perform the sacrifice. That means, what does that mean, Maharaj? He received Upanayana, or he would have received the Upanayana. So he might be 12 years old. Correct? I don't know. Maharaj is expert in these things.
Yeah, whatever.
He might be as young as 12 years old, or 13, or 10 even. You know, whenever his father determined that this boy is now learned enough to assist me in yajna, that's when he would receive what's called upanayana, that's sort of like pre-initiation. And then he would assist his father. So he's a very young boy, and he had already been married, again not full-fledged living together, but the girl was chosen. He knew who she was, and she's described as being extremely beautiful. I believe as beautiful as the goddess of fortune, that's how she's described. So all of that was there, but he happened to see one Shudra and Shudrani on the side of the road embracing sexually. And from that moment on, his whole life went to hell. He just couldn't control his mind anymore. Even though he'd been so nicely trained up, this shows how powerful calm lust is. So it was when he was 80 years old, so that would have been, you know, some 60 some years later, of 60 some years of gross sinful activities, that he chanted the name of Narayan, not intending Narayan, intending his son. And so the Yamadutas were just, you know, very happily reaching out to grab, and the Vishnudutta suddenly appeared and stop. You can't touch him. So that in itself is moksha, right there. When one is relieved from one's sinful reactions, when one is done, consider how many, it's all described in the Bhagavatam, how many sins he performed. But he was, those sins could not accrue. The Vishnu Dutas, they interfered with the Yamadutas. You can't touch him. You can't touch him. You can't touch a hair on his head. Don't dare. And the Yamadutas could understand these Vishnu Dutas are very serious people.
Four arms and all the
symbols of Vishnu, and you know, Sudarshan Chakra is very. Sudarshan Chakra is said to be. I read one description of Sudarshan Chakra which says that is a gigantic, because it's also the wheel of time, so it's a gigantic, intensely effulgent wheel. Just like in the Govardhan pastime, Sudarshan Yagya was sent by Krishna above the Govardhan hill to turn the waters of devastation to steam, because the water was still coming down and gathering and threatening to close in on the Brajbasis. So Lord Krishna sent Sudarshan up to the top of the mountain just to stay there, to turn all the water to steam so it would just float off. And so actually no water came down at all. And it is said that Sudarshan was there 7 times hotter than the sun. And that was for that purpose. In other words, if he wants to be, he can be 12 times hotter, 50 times hotter, 150 times, a million times hotter. There's no limit to how hot Sudarshan can become. But for that purpose, it was enough to be 7 times hotter than the sun. And so this is radiant, intensely hot disk spinning, and within the disk, one can see every weapon in existence, in the material world and in the spiritual world. In other words, there's atom bombs, there's hydrogen bombs, there's those B-2 stealth fighters, bombers, there's every type of weapon. The power and the form of those weapons are within Sudarshan. And those would be the most, you know, gross and primitive forms, like stone axes, and that said that David killed Goliath with a stone that he threw from a sling, things like that. But then you've got the weapons of the demigods, and then you've got the weapons of Vaikuntha, all there. So in other words, Sudarshan Chakra is the archetype of every type of weapon there is, even in the spiritual world. Its origin is Sudarshan. So these Yamadutas, each one of them had a Sudarshan Chakra, so we don't want to mess with them. So, and of course, the Yamadutas were bewildered. You know that we don't need to go into that, but that's why they went to Yamaraj to ask him, who's really in charge of this place? You see, how is it possible? He was so sinful. But that's the effect of chanting Namabhas. Namabhas means he chanted only the reflection of the holy name. And he got moksha. Moksha means the result, say, in Treta Yuga one gets from following very strictly Dharma. You see, Dharma, the Chaturvarga, these four stages of human life, then one can get moksha, one can get deliverance from one's sins and become a liberated soul. Well, he got that, Yamaraj got that at the Artha stage. That was the next immediate thing he got. He did a little in terms of, compared against all the sins he did, just a little bit of Dharma. Chanted the name Narayan a couple times. And his artha was moksha. you see. And then the real moksha came when the Vishnu Dutas told him, we're going to give you more time. You will not depart from your body now. Now you stay in your body and you perform devotional service. And when you become perfect in bhakti yoga, then we will come. And then you'll go back to Godhead. So that also can be referred to as moksha, but Vaishnavas don't like that. So go back home, back to Godhead, to directly serve the Lord in a loving relationship that is beyond moksha, that is, of course, prema bhakti or rasa bhakti, prema rasa bhakti. So, in this age, a little bit of the real Dharma goes such a long way, there's no use in speculating about it. Just like if we go out in Harinam and we see sometimes we see some very degraded. I think anyone who's gone on Harinam, especially in the West, you've all seen this, some very degraded looking persons. But for some reason, they're there and they're, you know, snapping their fingers and bouncing their head and chanting along, you know, maybe doing some kind of crazy dance. And sometimes there's some discussion among the devotees, what will become of him? But there's no point in having such a discussion because it's impossible to calculate. That person may greet you when you go back to God. That may be the person who is waiting at the entrance of Goloka Vrindavan saying, oh, nice that you've come, please. I'll show you around. Please come. Let's go see Krishna. There's just no way of telling. So, what is his specific duty? And what is the duty of a human being in all circumstances? So that's yajna. So in every age there's yajna. In this age it's sankirtan yajna. That's what we should be doing. And then the second question, what is his specific duty when facing death? And interestingly enough, as we're going to find out in the second canto, that's also sankirtan yajna in any age. Because that's exactly what Shukadeva Goswami, he will recommend himself. He will say, there's another form of yoga that you can do, which is the acme or the peak. It's the last, or maybe the second. If you want to say bhakti yoga is the last rung of the yoga ladder, if you want to say that. But I think we should, before saying that, we should remember that Prabhupada compared bhakti yoga to an elevator. So it's not even on the yoga ladder. It's not the last rung. Because to become a devotee, you don't have to climb those previous rungs at all.
It's the ladder.
You just press the button, get in, and ding, up you go, without any effort. So that's the real analogy. So there's a last rung of the yoga ladder after one's gone through karma yoga, jnana yoga, and siddhi yoga. Then there's this meditation upon the universal form, and this is also in the Vedanta Sutra, in a kind of, because sutra is code, so it's a condensed form describing the same thing. That's in the moksha part. So the same type of yoga. One is gradually ascending through the universe and coming to Brahmaloka, and then having arrived at Brahmaloka, one stays there with Lord Brahma, and then at the time of the Mahapralaya, one goes with Brahma to Mahavishnuloka, the entrance to Vaikuntha. And if you're lucky, and this Brahma that you're following happens to be a devotee, then he will go beyond Mahavishnu Loka and actually enter Vaikuntha. If you're not so lucky, then that Brahma will come back. It's described by Srila Prabhupada in Canto 3, in a purport, he's quoting Madhvacharya, and he's describing this as the actual fall down of the jivas. Very interesting. The fall down of the jiva is not the first time, it's not the first time the jiva comes to the material world and acts as Lord Brahma. Because that first time, he's coming as a servant. And he's given all opportunities by the Lord simply to do this one lifetime of service and then come back. But if, while performing that service, he becomes attached in his mind to that big position, Brahma, it's like God, you see. I mean, who are they worshipping? When the Christians talk about God, how did they describe him? The Creator. You see, so many religions of this world, ordinary mundane religions, are actually aimed at Brahma. And he's the first of the Brahmanas, all the Brahmanas, you see, they all come from him. All the Gotras come up to him. So those who follow this, it's called the Vaidika line, then all of their worship comes to him, and then from him, through him, it goes to the Mahapurush, the deity of this universe. So he might become attached if he is inclined to karma or jnana. Well, yes, if he is inclined to karma again, he will become attached to his position as Brahma. And that means he'll come before Mahavishnu and offer prayers. And there might be some followers behind him kind of looking at their watches. I wish he'd hurry up with those prayers so we can go through it into Vaikuntha, but he keeps on offering prayers, and then he starts offering the prayers that we find in the Bhagavatam. Please now breathe out, O Lord Mahavishnu, so that we can reassume our positions in the universe. And those who had planned to go to Vaikuntha go, oh no! And that's why Prabhupada writes, I'm not sure if it's that purport or another, I think it's that purport. Oh, it says, this is why those who worship demigods are considered foolish. Their intention is to go to Vaikuntha, but because they worship the demigod, you see, and not the Supreme Personality of Godhead, therefore, they may not achieve the result that they wanted to get. They may end up going back. And Prabhupada said at that point, in one morning walk, he said, he may not go back into the material world as Brahma again. Prabhupada actually said, as Brahma, or as cat, or as dog, or anything. Whatever desire, because his material desires are stirred up. So whatever desire is most prominent, the real desire, the real thing, the real root, that is the reason why he doesn't want to go to Vaikuntha, that becomes prominent at that time. And that might lead him to even a much, much lower form of life than that of Lord Brahma. Or he might again become Brahma. Or whatever. Anything is possible. So, therefore, Shukadeva Goswami, although he's saying this form of mystic yoga is there in second canto, we find again and again he himself is personally recommending the what he calls the doubtless and fearless path, Harinama Nukirtanam, Harinama Nukirtanam. This is the doubtless and fearless path back home. Back he again and again says that he sort of inserts that, even as he's explaining the other yoga system. He's explaining it, but then he says, but those who are more intelligent, then they hear and chant the glories of the Lord. So he makes that, and by the end of the second chapter, it's very clear that this is all Shukadeva Goswami is interested in speaking about. That is actually the purport of the Chatushloki Bhagavata. So, to continue, Yes, these queries are not easily answered, these two queries. For Srila Prabhupada notes in... Oh, no, we already read that yesterday. I just wanted to explain those two questions. But this is important. We'll review this too. Notes in 24p. Practically the whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam, beginning from the second canto up to the last 12th canto, deals with these two questions. That's important, and we should remember that. So now to move on, the sages, in response to these two questions, they begin to discuss among themselves, well, how should we answer this? What's the best way to answer this? And so a discussion ensued among themselves. And Maharaj Parikshit wasn't getting a clear response. And as I noted yesterday, but that didn't mean that he suddenly became a faithless Buddhist. I mention that again because it just came to my mind that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he mentions in one of the Tattva Sutra or the Amnaya Sutra, one of these books, he mentions that Buddhism is the was the response of the Kshatriya class to the degradation of the Brahmanas in Kali Yuga. And Jainism was the response of the Vaishya class. And there's the difference between Buddhism and Jainism is academic, actually. They're both atheistic systems. Buddha himself, Lord Buddha himself, Sakya Simha, he was himself a born in the Kshatriya dynasty, and so he attracted many from that class, and of course it was Maharaj Ashok 300 years later, they say 300 years after Buddha was on the earth, it was Maharaj Ashok who made Buddhism the state religion of India. So although Maharaj Parikshit himself was a Kshatriya, he did not lose faith in the sages because they didn't give him a clear answer to his question. He, as Maharaj was saying yesterday, he very patiently and humbly stood there with his hands folded because he had stood up to greet the sages and he put the question. So he was just standing there with folded hands at their mercy. So now we start. As the rishis debated amongst themselves, by the will of Lord Krishna, Shukadeva Goswami appeared upon the scene. Having widely traveled the earth without any seeming purpose, Shukadeva appeared disinterested and satisfied with himself. He displayed no symptoms of belonging to any social order or status of life. For example, he didn't have a Brahmin thread. You see, in fact, he didn't have much of anything his body.
He had the ten directions.
what is it called?
Digambara.
Digambara. Yeah, he was Digambara, dressed in the directions. Around his person, foolish women and children flocked simply for their amusement. He was just an object of amusement. They were just standing there. You can just imagine giggling and pointing and whispering and guffawing. They gazed uncomprehendingly upon him as if he was but a madman. As if neither he himself nor others in his company had any concern for his appearance in the public eye, his body was devoid of even a single scrap of covering. This is from verse 25. Nimesha, number 9. In the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, it is said that Srila Vyasadev kept the daughter of Jabali as his wife. And they once performed austerities together for many years. Thereafter, when Vyasadeva impregnated his wife, the child remained within his mother's womb for 12 years. When Vyasadeva requested him to come out, the child said that he would do so only after becoming completely liberated from the influence of Maya. Srila Vyasadeva assured his son that this would be so, because after all, he's Srila Vyasadeva. So he could give that assurance. But the child did not have faith in his father's words, since he himself, his father himself, was a family man, was still attached to his own wife and children. So even though he's the incarnation of the Lord, the embryo within the womb was very, very intelligent. Well, if you're still entangled in household life, then how can I believe you that by my taking birth and having your association, that I'll become free from the same attachment? So Vyasadeva then went to Dwarka and informed Lord Krishna of his problem. Thereafter, at Vyasadeva's request, Lord Krishna himself, personally, went to the Rishi's cottage and assured the child that he would never become influenced by Maya. At this, Shukadeva came out of the womb and immediately left home to wander as a Paribrajakacharya. When the aggrieved father followed his son, as we see in the Bhagavatam, he followed his son and he was calling out, "Oh my son, oh my son." And it said the only answer he got back was the echoing of his own voice from the trees in the forest. That was the only response. Shukadeva created a duplicate self. He expanded another Shukadeva. And this Shukadeva later on became a householder, and his daughter Kritvi married King Nipa of the Bharata line. So that is sometimes known as the Maya Shukadeva. So you will find in the Puranas descriptions, you see, and this is why one should be very careful before one, like Prabhupada said, a real, in ISKCON, a real Brahmana is one who has read my books four times. So if before one has done that, read Prabhupada's books four times, and also that means under the guidance of a superior authority, one who actually can answer, because you shouldn't simply just read. Reading is the subtlest form of hearing, you see. When you read, the mind is vibrating those words that you're reading, so you're hearing. And so an automatic duty of one who is Kshatriya, hearing, is to put questions. Now, it's just like there are some who declare themselves disciples of some guru that they've never met, they've never received initiation from, but his picture is on the wall. They put his picture on the wall. There's my Gurudev, you see. And they may appeal to some mystical, "I had a dream of him and he said that you're my disciple," whatever. But that's their relationship, it's to a picture. So, all well and good, but that picture is never going to answer your questions. See? And that's why you have a guru. Prabhupada said, one should not keep a guru as a pet. And that's what one is doing. He's just keeping a picture of one's guru on the wall and nothing more. Then you might as well have a bird in a cage. Not one of the non-talking kind of birds. At least there are birds who can learn to chant Hare Krishna, and that's the answer to all questions. But the non-talking type of bird just makes nonsense sounds. Or, you know, some people have... There was even a rage in the 1970s. Shops were selling pet rocks. Can you imagine? They were selling rocks that you can pick up from the ground. They were selling them. Making money. This is business. And they were not Shalagram Shilas. They were just ordinary rocks anyone could pick up anywhere, but you know, they cost them a dollar or something, and it was labeled a pet rock. And then you'd buy it along with a terrarium. You see, there would be earth and some plants and things like that, and then you could put that in your house in a prominent place, and friends would come over. "Oh, what's this? You've got a pet?" "Yeah." "Well, where is it?" "Right there." "Well, that's just a rock." "Yeah, that's my pet rock." See? So, So, you know, a pet rock also is not going to answer any questions. So that's what Prabhupada meant by keeping Guru as a pet. He's not going to answer any questions. So, there's no use to that. So anyway, I've again gone off on some tangent. But,
how do I understand this Maya Shukadeva?
Oh, Maya Shukadeva. Yeah, so I guess what I wanted to say is that he acted as a normal Brahmana son, and stayed at home and learned the Bhagavatam and got married and so on and so forth. Whereas the real Shukadeva went off seemingly just wandering aimlessly, but he was directed by Krishna to answer these two all-important questions of Maharaj Parikshit. And although he did not even have a Brahmana thread, he was not, this Shukadev, the real Shukadev, did not belong to any ashram or varna. By answering these questions, by reciting Srimad Bhagavatam, he became the real spiritual master of Maharaj Parikshit. So that's actually, that's how Jiva Goswami, Prabhupada, in one purport says, Jiva Goswami defines the word diksha. Diksha means initiation, and Jiva Goswami defines it as transmission of transcendental knowledge. So with diksha, others take it to mean a ceremony, a samskara, fire ceremony, and you know this and that, and give a thread, and a name, but diksha actually means transmission of spiritual knowledge. So real spiritual knowledge that will bear fruit in the disciple, not whispering some dead mantra. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati talks of, I forget the exact term he uses to describe them, something very sarcastic, but he talks about these pseudo-spiritual masters of the Kali Yuga who are in the business of selling mantras. So they collect disciples. In other words, what they want from the disciple is a fee, you see. And then in return for that payment, they will whisper into their ear a mantra that is supposed to reveal that person's eternal swarup in the spiritual world. That, you know, you're a gopi, or you're this, or you're that. That's a dead sound vibration, because the person who's giving it is not qualified, and the person receiving it is not qualified. So, I will stop here. You've heard enough of me. There's 12 minutes for Maharaj now to truly enlighten us.
Sure. Means with that or continue?
That's the relationship, you know, like Maya Sukadeva to real Sukadeva. Sometimes I have to do something as the Maya teacher here. Maharaj allows me. That's why there's two teachers.
The son of Vyasadeva was only 16 years old. His legs, hands, thighs, arms, shoulders, and forehead were so beautifully shaped that it appeared his entire body was artistically shaped with the greatest taste and delicacy. Nimsha 10. In 26 purport, Srila Prabhupada comments, a respectable personality is described beginning with the legs, and this honored system is observed here with Sukadev Goswami. With beautifully wide eyes and highly raised nose and ears, his face was most attractive. His neck was well formed and beautiful like a conch shell. His collarbone was fleshy, his chest broad and thick, his navel deep, and his abdomen beautifully striped. His arms were long, curly hair was strewn over his beautiful face. The hue of his unclothed body reflected that of Lord Krishna. In the prime of youth, Sukadev was blackish and very beautiful to behold. Women found the natural glamour of his body and his attractive smiles most pleasing. Yet for their sake, he paid no attention to his physical attractiveness. Indeed, the inner fortitude of his unyielding asceticism starkly contrasts the sweetness of his outer appearance. The great sages present there were all expert in the art of physiognomy. Observing in him the signs of a Mahapurush, they honored him by rising from their seats.
So by piety, then these different qualities come up, these different attractive features. So these features we see is that the more the piety, the more the devotion, then the more it is, how you say, you know, the qualities like Krishna are there, because he's the epitome of beauty. So Sukadev then, being such a greatly elevated soul, he had these same qualities, even the same color as Krishna. And that. So all these are natural, beautiful qualities that are looked for. They may be very different from the present day. Like here it mentions, even though he's, an ascetic, the collarbone is fleshy. That means that there's something on the body. It's not skin and bones. So this very much militates against the modern concept that the more anorexic you are, supposedly, the more beautiful you are. Like that. But the Vedic standard is you actually are fatty, you know.
Yeah. Can I just, insert a little asterisk here that Prabhupada said regarding the six Goswamis and their well-known austerities of, Prabhupada said they slept maybe 15 minutes a day, if that. And all they took was a little bit of buttermilk. Mm. And he said, but they never were weak. Mm-hmm. He said, so one can do this. There's no, it's not forbidden for ISKCON devotees to follow the lifestyle of the six Goswamis, as long as you don't become weak, as long as you're not like this in the Bhagavatam class. As long as you're not crawling, you know, into the temple on your hands. That's ridiculous. Yeah. So, actually, this is what's really being shown here, is that a devotee, he simply lives fully depending on Krishna, even for the nourishment of his body. Mm. Somehow or other, the collarbone is fleshy, even though he may not be eating anything or just a little sip of buttermilk or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he has all the strength that he needs to perform regular activities. Mm.
It means everything actually expands out of the mind. The mind is actually the central point. And the whole, that's one of the things we'll see in creation, is that it's actually the mind that's expanding. From the mind then expands the gross elements. When you add false ego to the mind, then you get ether. You add again, then like this. So it's all expansions of the mind. So it's all held together with the mind. So if the mind is focused on Krishna, then one is very enthusiastic, because Krishna is the most wonderful, so one is always enlivened. So weakness in these are not a state of physical, spiritual form doesn't have fatigue or hunger or thirst or these. So therefore then, being situated like that, then they don't feel these. You know? There's that story of Raghunath Das. At one time then he became very sick, seemingly sick, and then they called an Ayurveda doctor, and he came and he took the pulse and this and that, and they said, what's wrong with him? He says, he's overeaten. They said, overeaten? The guy every other day takes a sip of, you know, buttermilk like that. You know. So then when he came out of his trance, then they asked him, you know, what was happening in that, and he says that there was some pastime was there, and he had made, I think, sweet rice or something for Radha and Krishna, and at the end, I guess he and the others were eating it, and he ate so much, you know, he was completely stuffed. So then that manifests here. So it's a, so subtle, gross comes from subtle always, like that. Yeah. So we see here is because of his consciousness, because of his, you know, that devotional piety, then he was very, very attractive. Another interesting point is how you could tell. This is one, all the ladies and that were hanging around, because he's very beautiful. Ladies like things that are beautiful. And so he was very attractive. He was cute, you know. But we see that here he mentions that he paid no attention to his physical attractiveness for their sake. Because the natural thing is you know, the cliche, you have a whole bunch of men sitting around being, you know, as slovenly as possible. And, you know, and as soon as a lady walks into the room, then they all sit up and try to, you know, put their chest out. And so they do all these things, this profiling. Women do it for the men do it for the women. So he didn't do that. So he wasn't worried that they, if they're attractive, he's not worried that they are and trying to increase that or take any advantage of that. So this is the previously pointed out that thing of indifference, because that's actually sannyas. Sannyas is not renunciation, because renunciation means it's the other side of attachment, like that. Sannyas is indifference. It doesn't matter. All the ladies are there gawking at him and this and that and smiling, or they're not there. He doesn't care. So it's not when they're there, then he's, you know, looking good, and when they're not, then he's looking, you know. It's just, he's just absorbed in the Lord. So this is the actual principle. Of course, that's different from anything we know. Therefore, emphasis is more put on renunciation, because we can relate to that, because we're very attached to something that it, we're annoyed in that attachment, or an obstacle is there in that attachment, so we reject the attachment. And so that makes very much sense to us. Love and hate, you know, attraction, repulsion, we can relate to that. So therefore we put the emphasis on renunciation. But the actual thing is indifference, which is something we don't know. You know, we would say, oh, he's indifferent or she's indifferent. But no, it's actually just a very quiet form of repulsion. Indifference means it doesn't matter.
You don't notice.
Yeah, you don't notice, or even you notice, it doesn't matter to you. Know,
well, Prabhupada actually said that a devotee, he gave the example of a tree.
Mm-hmm.
A devotee, Karmi will see a tree, a devotee will see also a tree, but not exactly a tree, because the devotee will see Krishna within the tree, or see the tree as Krishna's energy. So
it's noticing, you know, but not
it's
noticing.
It's not that the devotee is seeing something fantastic, wild, it's, you know, because he's got mystical kaleidoscopic vision, like in that Beatles song, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. He's not seeing a world like that. He's seeing the trees as others are seeing, but he's able to perceive the source of the tree. And there are different stages of this. One, he may be doing it just by Shastra Shakshush, seeing, you know, that he's so Krishna conscious that everything he sees, he remembers.
Mm-hmm.
Or it actually may be Divya Chakshush.
Mm-hmm.
He divinely can see the presence of the super soul within the tree. But he still sees the tree.
Yeah.
And can appreciate everything. You know, nice flowers, yes.
Yeah, because the beauty is Krishna.
Yes.
That's why when he goes by that was what was Vyasadeva's query was, Sukadev, who's 16 years old, extremely beautiful, and then all these naked, you know, fully naked, very beautiful young girls, he runs by, they don't cover themselves. Vyasadeva comes running by, they cover themselves. You know, one may think, well, Sukadev didn't notice them or anything, or didn't see them. You know, otherwise that would have been their answer. Well, he didn't look at us, that's why we didn't cover. But even if he didn't look, he might look, so they could, but they didn't. Because he just saw, here is young, beautiful, it's youth, it's Krishna's potency, it's Krishna's energy, it's, you know, Krishna's beautiful, youthful, like this.
So Prabhupada specifically says there that because Vyasadeva, they covered themselves because Vyasadeva made the distinction, you know, his way of seeing the world was to distinguish between male and female.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah. It's just that much.
Yeah, yeah.
you know, just because he had that. Yeah. Whereas Shukadeva didn't do that.
Yeah. Means it's means he can tell that this is a tree, this is a girl, this is this, but it's not that you put any system upon that or value upon it. It's just like, oh, here is Krishna's beauty, or that being manifested to the girls, or his, you know, what do you call it? That, you know, that
something falls.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. There's more. You know, oh, here's a tree, and that's, you know, Krishna's greatness is so big banyan, or it just goes on like that. Yeah. You know, it's not. Or they'll think of pastimes, or, you know, he may think of, you know, see them there and think of Krishna, you know, and the gopis when they stole their clothes or anything, but it's not a matter of that there's a distinction made, so therefore I get, there's gain or loss. Mm-hmm. That's what they're, well, Vyasadeva, that was his business, was to write the Shastra, so you can tell, you do this, you will progress, you do that, you will not progress. So even if it's, you know, nicely done, still, the difference is perceived, so then the girls would.
And they were acting according to the Dharma that Vyasadeva expected.
Yeah. You know. They would cover.
So everything was in order, but that.
Shukadeva
was beyond that.
Yeah, because he's also Purush, because you also see this when Shiva came by with Parvati, with Sarmishta and Damayanti. No, not Damayanti. Yeah, Damayanti. Yes. When he came by, they also covered because he's Purush.
Yeah.
While Sukadeva wouldn't be Purush, he's neutral, indifferent. So he's not manifesting as male or female. Yeah. You know, like that. So it's just a matter. It's just like little kids. A little kid can tell the difference, this is my father and this is my mother. But it doesn't mean that there's any gain or loss from that. So that's why if the little, you know, these little 3-year-old kid walks into the room when the women are dressing, nobody, you know, shrieks and covers up and all that. They don't care because he doesn't make any distinction like that. No, he can tell what's what, but it doesn't have any. There's nothing to gain from him from it, at least physically. You know?
Yeah, because there's a whole chain of material logic that follows. You've got man, you've got woman. It's like, what was that? There was an old TV show, Doctors. About a doctor, and then they put. It starts off with man. Putting
oh
the
yeah, yeah, and then
the
eternity. I think it was Dr. Kildare, wasn't it?
I think it was Ben Casey.
Ben, no, General Hospital, I think.
I don't know. Anyway, Casey. But the science, man.
Yeah,
woman,
and then
birth,
death, and then
infinity. And cool. So there's a material logic that follows.
Just keeps on going. And there's birth, death, and that keeps going. Yeah. That's on the chalkboard.
Okay. I guess we have to.
Yeah, so we'll end it.
End it this time.
Grantaraj Srila Srimad Bhagavatam Ki, Srila Prabhupada Ki.